don't think you get it. I think the fact that you're general counsels, you defend your company, that what we're talking about is a cataclysmic change. What we're talking about is the beginning of cyber warfare. What we're talking about is a major foreign power with the sophistication and ability to involve themselves in a presidential election and sow conflict and discontent all over this country. We are not going to go away, gentlemen.
Senator Dianne Feinstein chiding representatives of Facebook, Google, and Twitter about Russia and the election. The tech giants made the rounds this week, sitting in front of three committees, answering questions and doing lots of listening patiently and nodding. Here's Republican Lindsey Graham, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Information is power. Ideas are the essence of democracy, the exchange of ideas. Being able to criticize each other is one of the things that we cherish the most. But what we have to be on guard as a nation is having people who want to undermine our way of life using these platforms against us. And I think this is the national security challenge of the 21st century.
Okay, to talk about this, Shani Jardin is here. She's co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web and tech commentator. Hi, Shani.
Hey, Madeline.
We're also joined by Cecilia Kang, technology reporter for The New York Times. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, let's begin with you. Facebook acknowledged on Monday before the hearings that more than 126 million users maybe saw these political ads bought by a Kremlin-linked company. That number might be going even higher than 126 million. What more did we learn this week about these ads and how they spread?
We did learn that more people than Facebook even announced on Monday could have seen these ads. They said during the hearings 150 million people actually may have seen these ads on Facebook and Instagram included. We also learned what these ads look like. The House Intelligence Committee released a sample of the 3,000 ads that Facebook had turned over to the intelligence committees to show the public what we're talking about. These ads that have been talked about for quite some time obliquely now came to surface and to light, and we were able to see that the level of sophistication that this company that was backed by the Kremlin, this level of sophistication that this company had in targeting American audiences with a very sophisticated view on the social issues that are particularly divisive in the nation and around the time of the election that would stir up a lot of attention, such as racial issues, police abuse, religion, and immigration.
Okay, and Shani, you saw some of these ads. What do you think the purpose was of pretending to be black activists, for example? What were these Russian ads trying to do?
Well, far be it from me to truly know what the strategy was, with Putin and his troll army. But what it looks like, and this was the refrain that I heard following the hearings on Capitol Hill over the last few days, is that this was all about sowing discord, sowing chaos, sowing a kind of distrust of the social dialogue, of the process of even vetting the candidates, this sense. And people, by the way, were talking about this while it was happening, saying, gosh, some of this looks like the kind of thing that you would do if you were trying to create cyber war through social media.
Okay. And Cecilia, following up on that a little bit, sowing discord, sowing dissent, but also trying to gin up support for one candidate over the other. In other words, Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton, or were these politically neutral?
There were some explicitly pro-Trump or actually anti-Hillary Clinton ads in here. One specifically by the fake account called Army of Jesus, for example, had a picture of Jesus Christ and the devil arm wrestling. And the caption read, Satan, as if Satan was saying this, if I win, Clinton wins, exclamation points. That was the headline of that particular ad. So there were some explicitly targeted ads toward one candidate in favor or against, actually, in this case, one candidate. The rest were much more about social issues. And again, they these ads really showed this level of sophistication that this company had in understanding what the big topics were of the time.
But let me just ask you, in that particular ad about, you know, this, you have this kind of Jesus figure who looks like Fabio and Hillary Clinton as the devil. It's really crude and silly. Would anyone really take that seriously?
Hundreds of thousands of people looked at that one and a lot of these ads, and many people liked these ads. So that means not only were they viewing it, they engaged with it. And I think that's the key, is how much engagement. The companies will say that this is such a small sliver of all the content that is on their site on a daily basis, and such a small sliver of small fraction of the amount of content that's politically targeted or generally about around the election time, just about election-oriented. However, it's hard to say how much these ads spread, and also this was just the analysis of one particular company, the Internet Research Agency that's linked to Russia. There could be much more that these companies have admittedly not been able to explore at this point.
And Shani, these ads, are some of them were purchased in rubles, and Sheryl Sandberg was asked by Axios why Facebook didn't block purchases in rubles. And she basically said, well, we're going to block all currencies. That's ridiculous.
Yep. And their poor lawyer who was sent in her place and in Zuckerberg's place to Capitol Hill. The CEOs didn't show up for the grilling. Her poor lawyer had that same. They were all trained on the same media material, the same crisis PR session, I'm going to bet, because the company line was this. If we block rubles, or if we block, let's say, this came up in the Capitol Hill grilling. If we block the North Korean currency, if we block this currency or that currency, how could we know that we are not also effectively blocking a kind of free speech? Maybe there is somebody laudable in Myanmar, in Burma, who wants to buy an ad to promote their micro investment into goats. You're blocking that along with what. Whatever disturbing psyops, disinformation, somebody might be trying to blast through those same channels.
And Cecilia, there is talk about having Facebook and Twitter and the other social media companies do due diligence and alert people as to who bought these ads. The companies, they're not necessarily opposed to that, right? But they want to do it voluntarily?
They want to do everything voluntarily, and they actually have announced that they new policies where they will voluntarily disclose who's purchasing political ads. Very specific kinds of political ads, I might add, not capturing the whole range of policy and issues-oriented ads that are sent during election time. So there is potential regulation looming that would force the companies to disclose and report the funding behind ad purchasers, people who buy ads on their sites, in the same way that TV broadcasters, for example, have to do that with the Federal Elections Commission. That is a bill that's being considered right now, introduced by Republican and Democrats. So the companies are trying to get ahead of that. They've announced their own voluntary measures that get a little bit closer to doing that. Twitter actually has gone the furthest in volunteering to make public all ad funding, not just political, but also commercial. But again, this is the companies to rely on these one or two companies to do these voluntary measures is probably not going to be enough in the eyes of some of these lawmakers that are proposing this bill, because they want to capture the whole industry. They want to capture all of the internet and make sure that all internet-based political ads are transparent.
Cecilia Kong, technology reporter for the New York Times. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Let's bring in another perspective here. Peter Roth is a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Well, you argue that we are really blaming the messenger and not the manipulator. You wrote an op-ed in U.S. News about that. Are you saying that Facebook and Twitter and these other social media platforms do not bear responsibility for these fake Russian ads proliferating and being spread throughout social media?
They don't bear any responsibility at all. If the complaint is that the Russians put ads on the internet to sow discord about issues of race and religion, we have the New York Times and CNN already doing that under the protections of the First Amendment. Facebook, Twitter, these other platforms were used to put ads on the air, and to blame them for the disinformation is like blaming the automobile companies for deaths by drunk drivers. This idea that we ban rubles, Okay, great, fine. So the Russians, if they want to do this, convert the rubles into shekels or Bitcoin or euro or dollars and pay it that way. There are plenty of workarounds. By focusing on the companies, you're actually taking attention off the problem of foreign influence in U.S. elections.
But isn't there an argument to be made that these are actually news companies under a different name, that they do bear some responsibility in the same way that newspapers, TV stations, radio stations do in terms of making sure that they're not spreading false news, that they are actually have some kind of journalistic standards in making sure that what they are spreading is not, utter propaganda or utter lies?
Well, then you run into the problem that we explicitly provide broad latitude for news organizations under the First Amendment. And I would be very concerned about the chilling effect on free speech if we classified these companies as news organizations and then decided to try and slap regulations on content or on content distribution. All of these ads, as I understand it, had disclaimers on them.
That's the whole problem. They didn't. And they are saying that now that needs to happen on social media.
No, the ads had disclaimers. The previous guest was talking about one that was paid for. I think she called it Army for Jesus. That's a disclaimer. May not be an accurate disclaimer, and there may be some steps that can be taken in that regard, but it's still a disclaimer. You have them on political ads now, and after McCain-Feingold, you have the candidates saying, I'm so-and-so, and I authorized this ad. And they're now using that statement in some cases, as in the Virginia governor's race, to add a little tag onto that disclosure statement that hammers home a point about themselves or about the candidate they're running against. We bought the election.
So you're saying that we should just let it go and buyer beware, and we need to counter these things with counter arguments, if you will.
I think that's absolutely true. You know, I see a lot of advertisements on the web for makeup and automobiles and various stimulants and supplements, and just because I see them, I don't run out and buy them. And nobody has yet demonstrated that despite the exposure that people had, 126 million or more people had to some of these ads, that any one of them says that they were in any way influenced to do something they wouldn't have otherwise done.
Shani, what about that? It's going to be really difficult to prove that these ads actually led to a certain outcome in terms of the election.
Well, yes, but it's in a way impossible to quantify exactly how they affected people. I think it's only the kind of thing that can be done years after the true effect is truly visible, and by then, frankly, it's going to be too late. These technologies will be replaced by others. But we do know that it was a powerful enough kind of attack on America that if the desired effect was to create a kind of chaos and a kind of distaste, disgust, and distrust with the political process, with the process of civil dialogue, then I think it was effective, and it will be repeated again.
Let's go back to the subject, because you said that it's not quantifiable, which means that the effect of these ads may have been zero. And so everybody is ginned up over something that had no impact. Voters have, voting is a right, but there's a responsibility to be an informed, educated voter. These ads, that there's no way to demonstrate that these ads had an effect. And I am very concerned about the impact that they will have on free speech, on the ability of people to engage in the political process. I do not want the government regulating the political process. I think that's dangerous. I think we've seen where that can lead.
Okay.
I believe if
this has become a utility for the political process, all right, as your other guest says, it is important that the public be informed, that we have reliable information on the candidates. Everybody can agree on that. If it's the case that these privately held companies are now providing that utility, then we need to look at what responsibility they have. to ensure the quality of that information. And if we have a problem with that public-private dichotomy, then what are we doing to create some other form of perhaps publicly held showcase, internet-based based showcase for this political process?
Peter Roth is a contributing editor at U.S. News & World Report, Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, and our regular web and tech commentator. Thank you both. Coming up, how Republicans are trying to overhaul the tax code and what it might mean for you. We promise we won't make it boring. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Republicans unveiled their big, much-hyped plan to overhaul the tax system today. They're basically banking on it after repeated failed attempts to make good on their other big promise, repealing Obamacare. So what's actually in this tax bill? Well, there's a big cut for businesses, fewer tax brackets, and a big change to a rule that helps people buy homes. It's called the mortgage interest deduction. Maybe your eyes just glazed over, but it's a big tax break for most homeowners and could become one of the big sticking points as this bill progresses. Neela Richardson is chief economist for Redfin, the real estate company and database. Hi there.
Hi.
Okay, this allows people buying homes to deduct the interest they owe on mortgages up to $1 million. And the Republicans want to limit that to the first $500,000 in this new bill. And I want to note that realtors in general, they like this deduction. They don't want it changed, but many economists don't like it. You're an economist for a real estate company. What do you think?
Great. I'm right in both camps. I don't like this deduction in general. I think there is a need for reform. It tends to help high-income homebuyers and distorts the market. So that's the economist side of me speaking. I think, though, that it can be reformed and restructured so it helps more middle-class buyers.
And do you agree with the way that they're doing it in this bill?
No, I think it's a missed opportunity to help the middle class, particularly in California, where we know inventory shortages and high house prices are continuing to price out working class families from homeownership.
So what would you like to see instead?
A tax credit. You know, this mortgage interest deduction, the main problem with it is that you have to itemize, which means you have to be above a certain income level to benefit from the tax deduction. These are homes that would likely have been purchased by these home buyers anyway. So subsidizing them has no real effect. What we need to start looking at is the home buyers who need a tax subsidy in order to purchase a home. Those are middle-class buyers, particularly in high-cost California markets.
Doesn't this, in effect, work as a tax subsidy, though?
It does, but it subsidizes the wrong folks. It subsidizes the high income. It doesn't subsidize middle-class buyers who tend not to itemize. So there is a slant towards upper-income folks when looking at the deduction.
Right. And do you think that this, some economists have argued that this actually inflates the value of homes, that because it is only applicable to high-end homes or high-end home buyers, that it makes homes more expensive and makes the supply less robust?
That's the primary concern. But the real reality, especially in California, where median sales prices are well above $500,000 in the biggest metro areas, is the inventory shortage. There's just not a lot of homes for sale. And so middle-class buyers need a tax credit, something to help them really fight against this rising tide of low inventory. And that's not what we're seeing in this tax plan. It doesn't address the real need in a state like California.
So, but if you got rid of it entirely, wouldn't that drive down the price of houses?
No, not with the inventory shortages in most places in California. It, getting rid of it entirely is a bit of an oversimplification, because current homeowners would still get the mortgage interest deduction under most phasing out. It's really penalizing new home buyers and rewarding current homeowners. And that's the last thing we need to push the market forward. We need to find a way to help new home buyers purchase, not just enrich current homeowners who are already benefiting from really low interest rates and really high house price appreciation.
Neela Richardson is chief economist for Redfin. Thank you.
Thank you.
And joining us now, Adam Davidson, staff writer at The New Yorker and the co-creator of NPR's Planet Money. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, let's talk about this mortgage interest deduction. Congress has considered capping or getting rid of it for a very long time. It's never been accomplished. What do you think is going to happen this time around?
I guess I have a shot at this, capping it at $500,000. You know, today's the first day. We'll see where the politics lands. I'd say that was a pretty modest reform to go from, to cap it at homes valued at $500,000 or less. And so it feels probably doable, but I agree with the previous guest that it's a missed opportunity, and it's like much in this tax code, it benefits wealthy people.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so let's talk about another item that is raising a lot of eyebrows, and that is the proposal to get rid of the state and local tax deduction in California. That means you can deduct what you pay to the state from your federal tax bill. First of all, where did this come from? Why is this in the tax code in the first place?
This is one that really is in the, there are principles that are sort of ideological ideas that people have, or research-based ideas that people have, like what we just heard about the mortgage interest tax deduction. But then there are things that really are horse trading. And I think at least some Republicans were pretty explicit about this one. High tax states tend to be Democratic, and so they can try and ding Democratic states with minimal pain to their voting base. Although others have pointed out that, to keep the House and probably to win a presidential campaign, they need at least some blue state support. So doing something so wildly, beneficial to smaller, more rural states and so painful to California and New York, might be short-sighted from that political standpoint.
But why do we have it in the first place? I mean, why do we have a deduction for paying taxes?
I don't remember when that entered the tax code. It's
but a lot of economists don't like it, right?
Yeah, I mean, here's what economists want. It's very, very simple. They want it's not exactly a flat tax, because I think most economists do believe taxes should have some progressivity, meaning poor people pay less in tax than less a percentage of their tax of their income than rich people.
Mm-hmm.
But economists want almost no deductions and just a pretty clean, simple, this is what you pay. See, the problem, what you want in a tax code is you want it to not distort how the economy functions. You want people to be making career decisions, where to live decisions, how to spend their money decisions, based on the economics of those decisions. So should I buy a house? Maybe, maybe not. Let me decide, sort of based on what home prices are and what's going on in my family, and then I'll decide. The tax code shouldn't say, yes, you should, it's better for you to buy a house than to go on vacation, or it's better for you to buy a house than to go back to school or to open a new business or to do any number of other things. And similarly, the idea that the tax code is sort of neutralizing the impact of state and local taxes by saying, okay, the federal government is going to eat a portion of those taxes. So in other words, if I'm deciding, do I want to live in New York? Do I want to live in a tax-free state like income tax-free state like New Hampshire or Tennessee? I have to bear the full cost of that, which means I have to deal with my political system if I disagree. I have to, you know, my employer has to decide if it makes sense for me to do this. By the federal government kind of eating that cost, it diminishes me having to pay the full cost of that. So, using taxes to intervene in people's decision making, whether it's purchasing decision making, political decision making, is a lousy system. That being said, I live in New York, you live in California, and I don't want them to cut this deduction because it'll hurt me.
Yeah. And I guess it's a way for the states to say, okay, federal government, if you're not going to pay for all this stuff that we need to pay for, then we're going to make it a little less painful, right? I mean, they need to tax at a certain level to pay for schools and roads and all that kind of stuff that perhaps they're not getting as much money from the federal government to do so as they'd want.
Yes. I mean, you can think of the existing system where we do deduct our state and local taxes as a subsidy or a transfer from federal coffers to local coffers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm in New York, so I pay a fairly hefty city tax income tax, a fairly hefty state income tax, and some portion of that I don't have to pay because I get to take it off my federal taxes. So that means everyone else in America is paying me for that. And if this were part of a broader set of reforms that would make the tax code fairer, it would be hard to be against it. I mean, I do see this as a fairly partisan proposal at a fairly partisan time. And so even though in principle I might agree with the idea that state and local taxes shouldn't be taxed, there's a lot of things I think shouldn't be taxed. Shouldn't be tax-free or tax-deducted. And, you know, the fact that this is the one they're picking for explicitly partisan reasons is frustrating, even if I might in the abstract agree with the principle.
Adam Davidson, staff writer at The New Yorker, where he writes about money and finance. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marilyn.
Coming up, hundreds of thousands of Americans have stents put in their major blood vessels every year, but is there a real medical benefit? A new study says maybe not. Also, comedian John Hodgman has a new book out about the real him.
I've played an upper-class waspy jerk in so many different shapes and forms over my career, but you know, I would like the world to understand that I am that person for sure.
John Hodgman, coming up on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand with a good reminder that medicine is still an evolving science. Heart stents are a go-to treatment for blocked arteries. They have been for a while. More than 500,000 of the little mesh cages are put in each year. They're so commonplace, the procedure can seem about as serious as a root canal. But researchers at Imperial College London found that stents may not prevent heart attacks in many patients. Dr. Ravi Dave is the director of interventional cardiology at UCLA Health, and he's on the line now. Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. All right, this study recruited 200 patients with badly blocked heart arteries and severe chest pain, and they were treated with medicine for 6 weeks to reduce the risk of heart attack. And then some of them got a stent, and then some of them got a fake insertion. And they didn't know it was fake, but it was. Their cardio was tested 6 weeks later, and there was no difference between these groups. So what do you make of these findings?
First of all, it's a very interesting trial, and I have to say that this trial would be impossible to conduct in the United States. So I'm so thankful to our British colleagues for doing this trial.
Why impossible?
It is pretty much understood that if you have a significant blockage, the recommendation would be that you would have a stent and medical therapy would be a far inferior choice. So it would be difficult to conduct this sort of a trial in most centers. So because of the risk of worsening of patients' symptoms, if the patient had an untoward outcome while we were trying them on medical therapy, it would end up causing lots of issues, including legal issues. So it would be difficult to kind of perform this in the U.S.
Yeah. So this is sham procedure for the patients who didn't get the stent, in other words.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So do you have any ethical concerns about that, or is it just two countries of two different systems?
No, I think it is two countries of two different systems, but I think they have really given answers to a question that a lot of us have. What ends up happening in the United States is a patient with chest pain sees a cardiologist, ends up having some form of stress test that determines the high suspicion of a blockage. The patient then ends up having an angiogram and a greater than 70% blockage, like it was identified in all of these patients, is confirmed. And then a brief conversation takes place between the cardiologist and the patient, and the cardiologist then states that, you know, the reason why you are having chest pain is now easily explainable because you have a blockage, and it sort of makes sense physiologically that the blockage is producing all your symptoms. So one way to get rid of the symptoms would be to put a stent in, and patients tend to do well with these procedures. They're fairly safe. They tend to have relief of their symptoms in most cases. However, we're not doing what the one arm of the study did, and that is not do a procedure and follow the patient without letting the patient know if they had a procedure or not. And the patients did very similar to the ones that they ended up having stents.
So what's the reason for that? Because it does seem like common sense that if you open up the blocked artery, the patient would feel better and there would be less of a chance of a heart attack.
Right. So the reason why these patients felt better is that during the six-week period when they were up-titrated on medications, there was a very intense titration of medications. These patients were being called on a regular basis, and the medications were increased over the phone or with consultation with cardiologists, something that we don't do as much in the United States. Many studies have shown that there is a lot of power to medical therapy, and a lot of symptoms would go away with medical therapy. The disadvantage of that is that you have to continue taking these medications.
This is a statin, for example.
Not just statins, but you're taking anti-anginal medications, so these tend to be the beta blockers, the calcium channel blockers, the nitrates. So a lot of these patients were on three such anti-anginal medications. Huh. So, and for you to continue to have the benefit of medical therapy, you would have to likely continue taking these medications. Now, these patients were only followed for a six-week period, so I don't know how many patients at the end of 6 weeks or further down the line said, you know, we can't continue taking these medicines or the side effects are really preventing us from taking these medicines. So that could be a factor in the everyday practice. So
very quickly, we only have a few seconds left. Would you reconsider now automatically putting stents or recommending stents for your patients in the light of this study quickly?
I think there will be a conversation with a patient that medical therapy could be also of equal benefit. However, one would have to continue taking these medications. So one alternative to what the study did was have the patient go on medical therapy, reassess them a few weeks later. If they can continue taking medications, fine, continue to do so. But if you have chest pain that is still continuing despite taking medications, perhaps it's time to consider having a stent because placing a stent will almost always help you in some degree with reduction of your chest pain symptoms.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Dr. Ravi Dave, Director of Interventional Cardiology at UCLA Health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, humorist John Hodgman is here to talk about his new book. It's called Vacation Land, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you have a vacation home in beautiful Western Massachusetts, you're pretty lucky. And then if you buy another one, another vacation home on the coast of Maine, well, sounds like you're doing really, really well. But comedian and author John Hodgman manages to find the downsides of all this good fortune in his latest book. It's called Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. And John Hodgman joins me now. Hi.
Hello, it's such a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. So this is a memoir of sorts.
It is true stories. You know, I began my career writing rather arch absurdist books of fake trivia and invented facts. Now everyone is doing that these days,
yeah,
so it's not as quite as cool.
They're all following you. Yeah.
And doing characters on The Daily Show, The Resident Expert and The Deranged Millionaire, and hiding behind various versions of myself. And a couple of years ago, I started telling stories on stage that were much more straightforward and honest. And this book is born of those stories.
And so the...
And I'll be honest with you, I have two summer homes. That is the central dilemma of my life. Are you enjoying my relatable comedy?
Yeah,
everyone?
I really can relate to you. Two summer homes.
Well, let me be perfectly clear. The home in Western Massachusetts is not great. It's lovely. It's fine. It belonged to my mom, who passed away in 2000 and left it to my wife and I, who were in our very early 30s then and just about to have our first child. So we did a lot of difficult growing up there in the country because we were creatures of the city. We did not know how to fix a septic system. We did not know not to put 5 boxes of Cheerios down a garbage disposal. That's how you get a Cheerio tumor in your pipes.
And you have to take all your garbage to the dump, right?
Yes,
no one picks
a very uncomfortable errand for me because as an only child, it's important to me to follow the rules. And I was told very early on that it was not legal for us to bring our garbage to this particular nearby dump because it was technically in the next town over. And if I were ever asked where I lived by the dumpman, I was to lie to them. And this made me very uncomfortable because as an only child, I wanted to know what the rules were at all times so I could follow them perfectly and therefore be approved of and loved by every human on earth. And the lying to the dumpman in rural Western Massachusetts seemed like a quick trip to disapproval. And it made me very nervous. And I came up with increasingly elaborate lies for years before I finally realized and spent enough time in the country to know that they don't care. They were never going to ask because they work in the dump. And they probably aren't paid well enough to work in the dump, never mind about the provenance of this bag of food garbage and mouse bodies that you're there to throw in their hole.
But it does go to a central theme in your book, a pretty serious theme. I mean, there's tons of comedy in the book. It's really funny. But that you are pretty self-centered.
Say, it is really funny. Everyone within the sound of my voice. This is really funny, and I would say it is the white privilege mortality comedy of John Hodgman at my finest.
Well, right. So that white privilege part, that's when you being the only child, a white guy, and you have two vacation homes. By the way, do you use summer as a verb? Because if you do, that's another topic
entirely. No, I do not, believe me. Okay. And I don't, I mean, I've played an upper-class waspy jerk in so many different shapes and forms over my career, but... you know, I would like the world to understand that I am that person for sure. But my parents weren't. They were the first to go to college from their working class families in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, and Philadelphia, respectively. And they turned away from their Catholic faith and had one child instead of the many they were supposed to. And that was me. So, yes, I am a creature of profound privilege of many different kinds, layers, stripes, and flavors. But I don't. The fact of the matter is I've never summered anywhere. My wife teaches high school in New York City. I am marginally self-employed as a comedian, actor, writer, whatever it is I do. And so we have an opportunity to take a big chunk of our year during the summer and go live somewhere else. And anyone who has that opportunity, I beg of you, take it, because changing locations is how you learn about the rest of the world.
Mm. Okay, so you have this house in Western Mass, but
yes.
You also, then you decide you want to have this other house in Maine, or it's actually your wife wants
I
it.
I never made that decision.
Your
that
wife
was never my decision. My wife made it.
She loves Maine, and she wants to have a vacation home
yeah.
there.
She grew up, she has family there, and she grew up going there, and we've known each other and have been married for quite a long time. So Maine was always a part of our life, and it became clear over the past few years that it was really a place that my wife loved more than any other place or human on earth. And she instructed me that we were going to go eventually get a home there and accept our death there, which is called retirement. this certainty, this writing on the wall was very clear. I thought it might happen in another 10 or 15 years, but a home came up for sale that was just where we needed it to be, and we could afford it, and we weren't really going to Western Massachusetts anymore, so we got a mortgage and we bought it, and that's how you find me in this weird world where I have two different countrysides to go to, the rural Western Massachusetts where I spent a lot of my youth and did a lot of growing up, and the painful beaches of coastal Maine, which want to kill me and probably are right to do so.
Okay, so you talk a lot about your ambivalence about having this place in Maine, about being part of this world that you don't necessarily feel that you want to be a part of.
Well, Maine, but you are a part of. Yeah, I love Maine, but it's a challenging place. And in the name of the book, Vacation Land, it comes from the state nickname of Maine. It's called Vacation Land, which is kind of a cruel joke for anyone who goes there expecting a traditional American vacation. You don't swim in the ocean in Maine because it's made of hate and it wants to kill you. It's so cold. You get into it and every cell in your body screams the first half of the word hypothermia, and then you can't scream anymore because you're frozen. And the beaches are made of rocks and knives, and it's got a rugged beauty that exists to remind you that nature doesn't care if you live or die. That's what Maine is. And it's designed to provoke in some ways a vacation full of existential pondering rather than relaxing with Mai Tais on the beach.
Yeah.
And it's also a place of ambivalence for me because Western Massachusetts has a lot of colleges around it and a lot of young people are around. And like New York City, and in particular Brooklyn where I live, it's easy to still feel connected to youth, especially in New York where you never have to learn to drive and you don't live in a freestanding house. You have a glorified dorm room called an apartment. You never have to fix anything. Maine doesn't allow the delusion of youth. Many young people in Maine leave, leaving behind sad, lonely parents. A lot of retired people go there. And the young people who stick around on the coast, if they work on lobster boats and they spend a season pulling up Lovecraftian hell insects off the bottom of the coldest ocean on earth, they're not young anymore. They have a 1,000-yard stare that
yeah.
means they've seen more than you have. So that's a place where I quickly realized, based on the age of my neighbors, that I no longer belonged in a world of youth. The delusion that I was still cool or relevant in any way dropped away, and I had to admit that I'm simply a white male monster with terrible facial hair in his 40s staring down the second half of his life. And Maine offers a landscape of quiet horror that is appropriate for that kind of truth-telling.
I guess that's why Stephen King lives there. He gets a lot of inspiration.
Yes.
But, I mean, conversely, you could feel youthful amongst all this, all the aging populace. You could feel vital by comparison.
No, because I'm hurting too much from the things that I've walked on. Or the rocks that I've fallen on. Look, I don't mean to be disingenuous. I have really grown to love Maine a lot. And I am grateful that my wife dragged me there. You know, I don't see her very much up there because she has a sort of inherited Maine blood calling towards introversion. People mostly enjoy Maine because it mitigates human contact. And the happiest I've ever seen her is when she goes out in a rowboat and leaves me behind. But
let's talk about that rowboat because you spent a pretty penny on that one.
No, that was an incredible bargain. Didn't you read my book?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was a great bargain.
once we got to Maine, so we bought this house a couple of years ago, and immediately upon getting there, our kids just stopped hanging out with us. My son wouldn't play with me anymore. My daughter would go off to the local cemetery to visit the grave of a famous writer who lived in the town, and I don't know whether she would leave a little token there or dance on his grave. I don't know. Kids these days. And we were left alone to our own devices, and we ended up sort of fulfilling our loathsome class Caucasian destiny in the worst possible way, which was we bought a boat. In our defense, it's not a big boat, it's a 13-foot Peapod-style rowboat that was made locally. And equally, in our defense, we bought it by accident. We went to an auction, and we made the opening bid, thinking that it would be fun to make the opening bid because everyone was talking about how much this boat was going to go for, because Jimmy Steele, the guy who built it, who passed away a couple years before, was a legendary local boat builder. But as soon as we made that opening bid, everyone in the room looked down at the floor, took one step backward, and suddenly we owned a boat for a lot more money than we intended to pay for it.
How much did you pay for it at the end?
Well, the opening bid was $3,500. I had said to my wife, because it's a beautiful piece of craftspersonship, a very traditional piece of Maine nautical architecture made by a local guy who was famous for making these boats and also being angry all the time. And I wanted to see this thing. So we went to the auction and we looked at it and we both immediately fell in love with it. And I said to my wife, you should make the opening bid. It's $3,500. We know from talk around town that this boat is going to sell for $10,000, $12,000. And that's true. That's what people were saying. And everyone's here to see this boat because there's nothing else for auction here of any value. They're literally auctioning off a Folgers can of nickels, I think, over there. So this is the main event. But since we both love this boat, and now I'm in your world, and I feel the same calling towards the sea, I am saying to you, to my wife, please make the opening bid. Then we'll sit back and watch everyone else bid on it. And we'll know that even though we didn't win the auction, we had a hand in setting this boat off on its new journey, wherever it may go. And my wife said, this is why you are the greatest American storyteller. Yes, of course I will do this. But that is not what she said. She said, no, that's dumb. And we don't want to spend that money. And I confess I kind of bullied her into making that opening bid, and then no one else bid. The auctioneer bullied another person into making a counter bid of $3,600. By that time, my wife was in it. Her hand went up, $3,700, she yelled. And after about a 10-hour stare down with the auctioneer, who was furious that no one else was bidding, we suddenly owned a Jimmy Steele Peapod. And it is one of the greatest things in our life.
Oh, so you're glad you spent the money on it.
Yeah, it's a good boat. And the fact is that going to Maine was really giving up my world for my wife's world. And those are the kinds of negotiations that happen in marriages and partnerships all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But once we were on the water, it is dumb and on the nose to say, but we had a different point of view. The water was not something that had ever been in my wife's life. And now we were on a kind of neutral territory that we could share together. So that's why we live on a boat in the middle of a harbor. That's not true. We actually have a home.
Living on a rowboat, that would be challenging.
Yeah.
So your children, they're getting older now. And
yes.
Do they still like to hang out with you and go to your summer house?
Yes. Well, they love Maine very much. We have a teenage daughter and a son who will be a teenager sooner than I would like.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter works at the store and does other jobs. My son helped build a boat, and I'm excited that we have this opportunity to show them people who are living a profoundly different style of life than they would see in Brooklyn, New York. Obviously a non-urban life, and in lots of cases a life that is less centered around money because they don't have as much.
Well, John Hodgman, thank you so much. This has been really fun.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And let me just point out, it has been really fun. But I've enjoyed talking to you. This has been a lot of fun. And I mean, look, there's obviously a lot of heart in this book, a lot of honesty. I'm not sure everyone can take as much John Hodgman as they're going to get in this thing.
John Hodgman's latest book is called Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. And if you want more John Hodgman, he's coming here Monday night, November 6th. He'll be at the theater at the Ace Hotel. Nick Offerman will be there as well, so check him out there. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your evening, your day. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.